Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams sitting in for Ann today. For years, Netflix maintained that it wouldn't show ads. It would not show those ads in its programming. And when subscriber growth was steady, that wasn't a problem. Now, after losing subscribers in back-to-back quarters, the streaming giant has changed its tune. The company plans to have an ad-supported tier of its streaming service available early next year and is partnering with Microsoft to help make that happen. Sarah Krause covers Netflix and streaming services for The Wall Street Journal. She joins us this morning. Welcome to the show, Sarah. Sarah, Netflix, a bumpy couple of quarters. What's going on with that company?
It has been a bumpy couple of quarters for Netflix. They are at a moment in the streaming industry where there is intense competition. At the same time, consumers are being more thoughtful about how they spend money and trying to prioritize gas, groceries, basic necessities, as well as their in-home entertainment. Plus, consumers are returning to sort of post-late pandemic activities outside of the home. And so there's this moment where not only is there a ton of competition, but there's also a sort of rethink in terms of how consumer dollars are spent. And so all of those things together are putting enormous pressure on Netflix. And when it comes to ads, have prompted a rethink, a move away from the simplicity of you come here as a consumer and you won't see ads. And it's a simple experience where you don't have to worry about sort of corporate messaging or the disruption of ads. Now to let's create an ad-supported tier for people who are willing to tolerate ads and want to pay a lower price in exchange for seeing those messages.
And that price, you mentioned that. I mean, the Netflix price has gone up over the years substantially, and then you add ads to that. So basically, during the pandemic, they had a huge bump. A lot of us were kind of at home, working from home, watching a lot of binge movies and things like that. Pretty much, was that a period of time that was good for them, and now they're just coming out of it?
It was. That was a period in which Netflix and other at-home entertainment companies really benefited from consumers being stuck at home and not really having much else to do but sit on the couch together and stream. That has come to an end in some ways where, of course, people still binge some content, but the amount of time that you're stuck at home is far different now, and that pulled ahead some demand. I think what's also going on here is Netflix needs to create more revenue per subscriber that it has, and is thinking, in addition to ads, about cracking down on password sharing and better monetizing the people that actually are sitting there watching its service. So it's sort of had this moment where it's having to change on a couple of different fronts where it had previously sort of drawn lines in the sand and said, you know, this is a place where you won't see ads and this is a place where we're cool with password sharing.
But it's making all those changes because they're having such a swing in revenue. But I mean, do you think that the consumer is going to adjust to that? Because everyone knows, you know, you share your network, your Netflix password with your spouse, at least, or your kids. And that's kind of a tough ticket when it comes down to it. What is your reporting hearing about how people feel about the fact that they might not be able to share, you know, more than two people?
You point to a really important aspect of this, which is getting existing subscribers on board with the changes that are coming down the pike is a real challenge. How do you message the fact that you're going to start enforcing password sharing? How do you nudge people either onto their own plans or nudge a primary account owner to pay a little bit more for new people who have been mooching for all intents and purposes for a while off their passwords? And that is the challenge that they're facing in this moment. And at the same time, as you rightly point out, they did raise prices earlier this year, which caused an uptick in churn, which typically happens when a streaming company raises prices. But for Netflix, it remains sustained for a little while before now coming back closer to where it was prior to that price hike. So there's a lot of tricky events happening for them all at once that really do test the commitment of consumers to the service.
But competition has to be the big thing that's kind of cutting into their bottom lines. And so basically, that has to be the larger issue that they're facing, the competition that is forcing them to kind of do a 180, not a totally 360, because they're going to do like a support tier versus just commercials all the time, right?
Yeah, this will be similar to what Hulu has done, where if you don't want ads, you will still be able to have a subscription that is free of them. If you want to pay a little bit less and see ads, you will be able to opt into that. And the company has said it's something that you will have to choose to do. But certainly this sort of competitive moment, as well as, you know, sort of consumers' price tolerance being in question, together are leading this company to make a pretty significant strategic pivot. I mean, this is something on the ad tier that the company was vocal for years about not doing. They wanted Netflix to be sort of a sanctuary that didn't have the ads that rivals did. But then after a while, you sort of look at Hulu's business model and the fact that you can make more as a streaming company from both the subscription revenue and the ad revenue from running ads in a tier than you can from a subscription alone. And so what you're seeing is this company that leaned into the simplicity of doing one thing and doing it really well, now having to diversify that approach. And, you know, at the core of this is the fact that, you know, consumers expect good content and they only stick around if you continue to have hits. They're loyal to shows, not streaming services. And so what you see not only at Netflix, but at all of its rivals too, is how do we keep a steady drumbeat of hits such that we can keep consumers long-term and not have them turn the switch on and off when they're done with their favorite show.
So the company stock has lost roughly two-thirds of its value this year. And that feels like pretty severe. I mean, when you hear that, so that has to have like the stockholders and the decision makers that like really saying, okay, we may not be able to do something right this second, but we've got to make those changes because otherwise, you know, they're going to be in trouble.
It's a big deal, especially for a company that has looked unshakable for so long. Netflix was way out ahead in streaming and, you know, sort of teaching consumers this new muscle of binging at home and having immediate access to everything you want. And for a long time, their trajectory was straight up. And this is one of the reasons that they didn't embrace ads sooner is they sort of thought, you know what, we need to keep going on international expansion and continue to grab market share around the world without the distraction of trying to add this incremental revenue from ads. That is now starting to shift. And when you see the stock drop so severely, it is a crisis moment for people within the company. It does shake employee confidence and it really starts to trigger a rethink of how do we boost investor confidence? How do we make sure that we're giving consumers the full breadth of options that they might want in order to be willing to stick around with us?
So Netflix is partnering with Microsoft in this venture to go into ads. Why does the company need a partner to go into the ad business?
So getting into the ad business is difficult. It takes a tremendous technical lift as well as a sales force to start actually selling the ads. And when you're, if you're Netflix, you need to figure out not only what content you have the right to run ads in. So they have said that the majority of what's on their service can be moved into an ad back tier, no problem. But they do for other shows have to renegotiate their licensing rights to be able to do that. That takes time and effort. On the ad tech side, it takes expertise to build out the technology that helps serve ads and that actually makes the plumbing work. And that's something that will take time for Netflix to build by itself. So when it started to look at this project late last year and then announced it early this year, they knew very quickly that they would need a partner, at least in the near term. And so when they were looking for that partner, they wanted somebody who could help them for sort of 3 years to start out and who would offer a minimum revenue guarantee, i.e. if we help you with this, we guarantee that you will make at least X in ad revenue. And so that's sort of where they went into this. But they've said throughout this sort of learning process, they've been blanketing the ad industry, trying to learn about the nuts and bolts of the industry, what advertisers want, what tech they need. They have said this is a crawl, walk, run situation where we're going to start small and we're going to build up to something more fundamental that we build out internally.
So Microsoft, somewhat of a, I don't know, dark horse in the race to partner with Netflix. Why would Netflix go with a Microsoft versus one of the other big players?
Sure. So in the race for this prize was not only Microsoft, but Comcast, NBC Universal, and Google, which has YouTube, of course. And so one of the things that differentiates Microsoft and that they leaned into in the pitch is this idea that they are agnostic. They don't have a rival streaming service like a YouTube that is going to compete sort of head to head with Netflix. They also were willing and more interested in sort of being flexible and a short-term partner, which is what Netflix wanted as it builds out its own. It's more of a help us get this off the ground and we plan to proceed with our own internal work on it long-term.
Do you think it's going to take a lot of public relations to kind of get all this going for consumers, or do you think it's going to be a bumpier ride from what you're hearing, you know, as far as like maybe their revenue goes down before it goes back up?
It's a It is a market communication challenge because you're trying to make clear that, hey, consumers, if you don't want to see ads, you don't have to see them. You can opt into this. We're not forcing you. At the same time, there's the narrative around cracking down on password sharing and, of course, an ad-supported tier. And that effort could go hand in hand. They haven't spelled out the connection between the two, but it could be that you, you know, sort of say, you know, hey, Sarah, we noticed that you don't have your own account. Would you like to pay for one at a lower cost? By the way, it will include ads. You know, there's direct linkages between these strategic projects, but getting the messaging right and in a way that consumers can understand is a real challenge, especially because consumers have become so used to being able to share passwords and sort of associating Netflix with this sort of pure experience.
So big picture, with the number of services multiplying, the costs going up, and now ads coming back, do you think the streaming is becoming, you know, just a not such a good deal for consumers anymore?
You know, it's hard to say. Definitely in my reporting, I've talked to a lot of consumers who are trimming and being much more strategic about how many they keep at one time. And so they're sort of leaning into the idea that they have the ability to turn the switch on and off. And I think you'll continue to see more of that where consumers are saying, you know, I don't need eight or nine of these. I need to be more thoughtful about which one, two or three really are the most useful to me, which ones we find ourselves watching all the time. And so I do think that there is a pretty critical moment coming up for these companies of how do they make sure that they're the one that is kept.
So you talked about just how behemoth Netflix was in the whole game, kind of like really getting us on this whole binge ride throughout the pandemic and going forward. But I mean, now that they have so much competition, do you think that in the end, because of the competition, oftentimes it makes things better? You know, when you get competition, sometimes you have to kind of think outside the box, come up with better options, come up with better pricing plans. Do you think overall this could be good for the consumer?
Potentially. And I think that it makes the companies that are spending on new content more thoughtful about what they're putting money into. I think it's become much more clear that the quality of your catalog matters a lot more than the quantity of it. Consumers are being more discerning and they're following shows where they're released or where they live and they are not afraid to give up. And so in that sense, it does seem like this is a moment where consumers have the power. And that is something that all these services, Netflix included, are trying to adapt to. And, you know, you can't just infinitely throw money at content. You have to make sure that you're picking the winners and that in the meantime, you are making the most of the subscribers that you have.
My producer, Bobby, has got this question, and it's one for me, too. I'm not a really big fan of ads. So what are you hearing from folks about the fact that they're trying to add these ads, even in a tier off to the side? I mean, you know, most people just want to see the movie. They want to see the show. They want to avoid the ads as much as possible.
Yeah, some people feel genuinely annoyed by the prospect of seeing ads on Netflix. We see ads across the internet. It's something that we've long associated with a YouTube or when you're scrolling the internet and there are places where you expect to see them. And when you're used to relative sanctuary, it is a mental jump. And there were some consumers that I talked to for my story on this that said, you know what, I don't want that. And I'm annoyed because they have raised prices. They're cracking down on password sharing. And now they want to add a tier where I would have to see ads. Like, you've hit my tipping point and I'm not interested.
So also Disney Plus seemed to explode in popularity. What do you think that they're doing right? Are they just in the right place at the right time?
A real aspect of what Disney has going for it is the franchise value. So not only the beloved Disney classics, but also Marvel, National Geographic. Like, there's so much going on within that service that I think that they have had a slightly easier time remaining one of the go-tos and being a service that families can't quite bring themselves to shut off. And it's something that their kids are going to want to watch Encanto or Frozen. There are things that they associate with the brand that give you the warm and fuzzies. A lot of families go to Disney World. It is a company that has not just a streaming service, but this whole sort of franchise ethos and experiences on the back of that where families make memories and all of those together come together to influence consumer purchasing behaviors and whether or not they're willing or, you know, sort of interested in turning that service off.
Sarah Krause is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, and she covers Netflix and streaming services, which are definitely in the news right now. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Now, I'm Natasha Williams. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams sitting in for Ann Fisher. Workers across industries are feeling the squeeze from inflation, but those in the so-called gig economy, think Uber, Instacart, and DoorDash, are more vulnerable than most. At the same time, more people are joining the gig economy to supplement their income, benefiting the companies that own the platforms. Fez Siddiqui is a tech reporter covering automation and the future of transportation, including Uber and Lyft, for The Washington Post. He's been looking at the impact of inflation on the gig economy. Welcome, Fez.
Hey, thank you for having me.
How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. I've been writing about this issue.
And you probably had a lot to write about because of all the things that are going on, including the pandemic, which helped kind of push a lot of these gig economy jobs as well. So let's jump right in. Fez, could you tell us what is an overall view of what the gig economy is?
So the gig economy is sort of a, as we define it, it's a loose term for a lot of these jobs that generally fall under the umbrella of independent contractors that people take to either supplement their income, though they can certainly constitute full-time work, and otherwise do not follow the traditional employment model. So think, Uber, Lyft, being a courier for a food delivery company, but even freelance gigs, that involve writing copy or designing, doing art.
So how are companies and workers in this sector, how were they impacted by the pandemic? In many cases, they got more work, right?
Yeah. So it was sort of like a dichotomy, I guess, where on one end, the work sort of dried up. Think, Uber or Lyft, some of those drivers could not find trips because the services basically dried up. There were no rides to give. But then there was a lot more home delivery. People needed groceries delivered and people needed food delivered or necessities. So delivery really kicked into high gear. There was a range of reactions, and sort of an app like Uber spanned that range.
So for the ones who really amped up the Shipt and Instacart and those types of, did they kind of just really take off? Had they been like maybe stalled, or were some of them just starting and kind of really got a boost because of the pandemic?
I think certainly there was an uptick, particularly in that space. So if you're thinking about the home and grocery delivery, yes, like all of a sudden these apps were at the center of the conversation, where before ride hailing was sort of the big player in the gig economy. But, all of a sudden people really did need, again, groceries and basic necessities delivered to their homes. And the gig workers were playing a really important role as basically, essential workers.
Yeah, because in some instances, like say if you had COVID, you weren't supposed to go to the grocery store to get your groceries. So you really had no choice if you were following the rules other than to go to, get your groceries from Shipt or Walmart or someone that actually delivers your groceries, right?
Absolutely. And then there was this other factor of, people's incomes were drying up. I mean, there was the short-term economic shock that preceded, obviously, the long-term economic pressures. But like there were people who had to find work quickly, and they turned to delivery apps. So there was just this general shock to the system that I suppose was a bit of a surge to the gig economy in general.
So today, many of the gig in the gig economy are seeing their earnings kind of eaten up by gas prices and other expenses tied to inflation. What have you heard from workers about how they are feeling, in this space right now, in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, the workers we spoke with were talking about how they feel a bit squeezed the wages that they're used to earning are not necessarily sufficient in this market of high inflation, rising cost of living, gas prices. Of course, those wages are up according to the gig companies. You know, Uber and Lyft both say their earnings are at $37 per utilized hour. A utilized hour is an hour of, you know, giving rides or being on a pickup potentially. But the workers say, like, what they end up taking home ends up not getting them necessarily ahead of where they were at prior to all of this.
So companies like Uber and Lyft have already seen an increase in drivers that many attribute to inflation. What's going on there?
So the increase in drivers, according to the companies, is driven at least in part by those rising costs. People need suddenly an outlet where they can supplement their income or otherwise, you know, find ways to pad their earnings because this environment is necessitating it. So the companies say they're seeing a surge in supply. That actually is a departure from like what they saw in a lot of cases on the heels of the pandemic, where, you know, once those rides had dried up on Uber and Lyft, supply was down, at least in terms of actually giving rides, not making deliveries. And so this is a bit of a difference from what they were used to seeing. But now so many people are flocking to the gig apps as a way of earning extra money or otherwise surviving in this environment where costs of living are so high.
So how do more drivers joining these apps impact the workers that are already there? Because some people are still struggling with trying to make ends meet. They're using these services like Lyft and Uber. A lot of folks do both of them. And they're trying to make more money. But if more drivers are coming on, that means there's less opportunity in your city to pick up folks.
Yeah, some of the drivers we spoke with talked about how what ends up happening is there's an internal competition. Basically, if there is so much supply, and if in some cases it might be outpacing the demand, even though the companies say the demand is quite healthy, there's a competition for those rides. And obviously they're not waging it with themselves, they're waging it with an algorithm. So the rides, or at least the incentives, the bonuses might be fewer, more far between. So more supply, while the companies say it's good for them, the drivers say they're certainly noticing an impact, and it's coming at their detriment at times.
Well, with the recession, gas prices, that could bring an even bigger influx of new drivers. What have the companies said about this dynamic?
So not every one of these companies has weighed in, but Lyft was one that spoke in pretty clear terms about the potential impacts of a recession. And Lyft executives spoke of, quote, recessionary tailwinds. So tailwinds are obviously something that's helping the company along. And what they were talking about was how if a recession were to happen or any kind of, you know, sustained economic downturn, the companies, you know, like Lyft could benefit from this surge in interest and in drivers. And that would then help the companies along. Obviously, it's counterintuitive to, you know, the dynamics of a recession where people are struggling. But the companies say, you know, they have experience in that kind of environment. And that's an environment where they are sort of programmed to do well.
So they're basically saying they think they'll be okay, at least in the case of Lyft.
Yeah. And they talked about how, you know, they are companies sort of like born out of the Great Recession. And so this is not something they're unfamiliar with. But more than being okay, I think, you know, at least in terms of inflation, Uber's CEO said the environment essentially suits them.
So workers and activists have fought for years for better protections for gig workers. They've had some high-profile campaigns, but have those campaigns won any major victories for workers?
Certainly there there have been like efforts to establish wage floors and when you know, health insurance and job protections. I mean, in California, there was a ballot measure called AB5 that it basically determined whether gig workers would, you know, become employees and have healthcare and job protections established. It was the gig company's response to that effort on the part of workers. AB5 established a wage floor and it established healthcare subsidies, but it fell far short of what some of those labor groups were pushing. It was the company-supported measure that basically instituted some of those protections as a reaction to what the workers had been pushing. So as far as winning that fight, I mean, I think the workers on that side would admit it's still sort of an uphill climb.
What about some smaller victories? Have there been some things that have put in place to hour changes, restrictions, things like that, that have helped workers?
Certainly, like on transparency, you know, workers on Uber can now see in a lot of cases, like, where a trip might be taking them, or in others, like whether a trip is worth their while. Transparency is really big for them so that they can like plan, you know, whether a trip is going to take you 2 hours out of your way, and whether that trip might be worth your time. So there have been concessions like that, that workers have won and hailed. But as far as upending the employee contractor model, that one is still outstanding for those workers who are pushing for it.
Well, something pretty attractive about these jobs is the flexibility that comes with them. A lot of expenses that an employer would normally cover, right?
Yeah, I mean, for the gig companies, obviously that makes their supply of workers less expensive to the companies. For gig workers, certainly some feel the flexibility actually benefits them, because they don't want established hours. They don't want to have to work a certain number of hours a week or deal with the employment model. So it really comes down to their preference. The one thing I'll note is that gig workers who are doing, I can't remember if it's the majority or the plurality, but a significant share of the work end up being the ones who are working longer hours, if that makes sense. So it's a small pool of workers who are doing a large share of the work because they're spending so much time on the platforms.
So what have the workers you've talked to said about why they sign up for these jobs? Is it strictly economics? Is it sometimes I'm bored, sometimes I need to just make some extra money for vacation, or a combination of all of those things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a range of reasons, like the ones you listed. Certainly people who need extra income or who are between jobs, who sign up and find a way to earn a little bit of money. The concern then becomes with the longer they spend on the platforms, some of the workers have spoken of, you know, evaporating bonuses and incentives that basically leave them dependent on the apps for the money they provide, but then having to work longer, having to put in more time and effort to take home the same amount of money as when they joined.
So switching gears a little bit, you cover automation and the future of transportation. Are driverless cars the future of the industry? We've had some high-profile stories that were not so good for some of the popular driverless cars. What is the future of that?
You know, I think the companies have said as much. So the gig companies certainly have put a lot of resources into the development or funding of driverless cars. I mean, if you think about it, this eliminates a key area of cost for them. Obviously, you know, paying drivers is a big part of their expenses. They would no longer have to do that. So economically, they say, you know, this is their future. At the same time, driverless cars have still have quite a long way to go. The idea of widely available, you know, on-demand driverless vehicles that consumers can hail in any part of the country in any conditions, that's still a ways off. So, you know, the companies, I think it's cooled down a little bit, but like while they have claimed, you know, this is the future, and the model is predicated on it, I think it's worth taking with a bit of a grain of salt, at least as they're laying out specific timelines. To date, there is not a believable, reasonable specific timeline that I've seen for the arrival of driverless cars that can serve consumers in any city and in any condition.
So no one has thrown out like in 2050, there'll be, you know, 10% driverless cars.
Dates have been thrown out, and then like those deadlines we've blown through them. So I just tend to take them with a grain of salt at this point.
Fez Siddiqui is the tech reporter with the Washington Post covering automation and the future of transportation, including Tesla, Uber, and Lyft. Fez, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
I'm Natasha Williams. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams sitting in for Ann Fisher. The Inflation Reduction Act, which passed the Senate this weekend, included a $7,500 electric vehicle tax credit. But thanks to certain stipulations about where the batteries are made, only a fraction of the electric vehicles on the market today would qualify. Here to tell us more about that is Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, Russell, let's jump right in. This is tied to rules meant to combat Chinese dominance in battery manufacturing. What's going on?
Yeah, so, you know, rules as written, as far as this new Inflation Reduction Act, you know, kind of benefit for battery makers here in the U.S., is that any EV tax break after 2024 would only apply to batteries where at least 40% of the minerals were sourced from North America. And that actually is going to extend into 2029, where those battery components would have to be 100% made in North America and not have mineral pieces that come from any country outside of the U.S. Or Canada. That is a challenge, as was pointed out by a couple of folks who actually make the EV cars. There are 72 models available for purchase in the United States right now, including plug-in hybrids and fuel cell electric vehicles. Of those 72 models, only 70%, I'm sorry, only 30% will be eligible for the 2024 stipulation, and actually none of them that are currently available would apply for the full credit that would be available in 2029.
I mean, so what does that mean? I mean, does that mean like a slowdown of the manufacturing of these particular vehicles?
As it stands right now, it means that auto manufacturers that are selling electric vehicles in the U.S. who want to, you know, kind of approach that that discount are going to have to spend the next 2 years trying to make sure that they can get the materials necessary to build batteries here in the U.S. in a way that would not increase the price of those batteries so much to render that discount completely useless. Now that's going to be a significant challenge for most of these companies, especially with kind of a 2 year gap. But it's, you know, an important thing to do as far as making sure that those parts are in fact sourced here from North America.
I guess it'll really come down to how far you are in the pipeline. If you're already in the process, but it would probably be a longer way to go for someone who is getting into the EV market.
Exactly. You know, there are a lot of auto manufacturers, you know, when you design a car to be released on the market, that's not a short period of time. It's usually more than a year in many cases to design those parts. And typically when you have a contract with a battery manufacturer or really kind of any parts manufacturer, the goal is to have those kind of shipments set up over a set period of time. The Alliance for Automotive Innovation says that this could set back the collective target of electric vehicle sales by as much as 40% by 2030, depending on how auto manufacturers choose to respond to this new rule.
So a lot of this has to do with China, okay? So how dominant is China in this space?
Yeah, I mean, Chinese batteries make up a significant portion of the you know, either the acquisition of minerals that go into the batteries or the actual batteries themselves, depending on manufacturer. Each manufacturer has a wildly different way of approaching this. A big reason that Tesla had set up manufacturing facilities outside of the US is because it would put those vehicles closer to where the actual minerals are coming from. You know, the shipping costs would be different because you'd be shipping the entire battery versus the individual components. So a lot of that could potentially change over the next 2 years in order to avoid what would end up being pretty significant cost increases in vehicles that are already pretty expensive. You look at electric vehicles and even the ones that are designed for kind of budget consumers are still, you know, in many cases more expensive than their gas-powered contemporaries.
So when you talk about the expense, EVs are already pretty expensive. Would these rules just totally exacerbate that?
We don't have an exact number for how expensive it, you know, could end up making things. But I, you know, potentially more problematic than the expense of the battery would be a slowdown, a reduction in battery manufacturing progress. You know, a big part of cars that are being made right now is this sort of promise that in, you know, in maybe 5 years, there could be, you know, kind of 1/3 increase in the actual battery range. So right now we've got a lot of these EV cars that are able to go, you know, anywhere from 200 to 300 miles on a single charge. But the promise from a lot of these automotive manufacturers is that, you know, that there's this goal of having a single charge get you 500 miles or potentially more, because charging the battery takes a lot longer than filling the car up with gas. And so, you know, being able to address that kind of rapid charging includes making the batteries last longer, or making it so that the batteries can be charged faster. And both of those things require, you know, this kind of leap in technology that is potentially impacted by now needing to be very specific about where you source those materials from.
I think, go back a little bit, I think you touched on this, but how long would it take to build out the U.S. battery manufacturing space? I mean, to do our own, I mean, since we have such a small percentage that, you know, don't touch some part of the U.S. They're coming from everywhere except the U.S., right?
Yeah. So this is actually a really interesting challenge, because we do actually have several large battery manufacturing companies here in the U.S. There are factories in Tennessee and Kentucky. General Motors has offered to, you know, build new battery factories here in the U.S. And I think Toyota started a massive facility in North Carolina. The problem is that a lot of those manufacturers still get their materials from outside the U.S. The ones that I mentioned in the ones that I mentioned in Tennessee and Kentucky still come from South Korean battery manufacturer SK, and a lot of the materials are still not, you know, 100% sourced from North America.
So talk to me, Russell. I know you want to talk about some other things. You also want to talk about child influencers and labor regulations. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this has been a really interesting...
I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know, a lot of TikTok families, I watch these TikToks and kids are all over TikTok. So the kids, I see the same kids every day doing TikTok dances, doing just regular things in their regular life. It seems like they're working while they're at home.
That's exactly right. And that's, you know, one of the world's most famous kids now is Ryan Kaji, who, you know, any parent of a young child probably knows this face from Ryan's World on YouTube. This kid he does everything from opening new toys to, you know, testing new foods. And he has his own line of toys. You walk into Target right now and you can find Ryan's World toys sitting on the shelf, you know, kind of random blind box things. This is a 10-year-old who is in front of a camera for multiple hours a day, entirely separate from his schooling and any socializing he might have with other kids. There are an enormous number of hours in a given day, week, month that this kid spends in front of a camera, specifically for the purpose of making money. You know, his parents, are very much, you know, that this is a business that gets run, you know, for this. And Ryan is by far not the only one. You mentioned, you know, tons and tons of kids on TikTok, either out of their own volition or being, you know, kind of motivated by parents. You know, this is kind of a resurgence of child actors in many ways. But the difference between, you know, child actors as we know them in a traditional sense and social media is that there are no regulations currently for how long those kids can safely be in front of a camera or, you know, kind of what environment they can be safely in. And so there are all across the world now conversations happening either in UK parliamentary committees or here in the US or Australia about potentially having laws in place to safeguard kids working in the entertainment industry, because that's effectively what they are.
So you say there's nothing in place currently. And so we're just starting to talk about that. And all of this obviously brought about by just the explosion of social media platforms.
Yeah, that's right. You know, here in the U.S., it's the bill that was introduced is called the Kids Online Safety Act. You know, the conversation that's being had there, you know, a big part of it is, you know, first of all, how do you identify, you know, when someone fits into this particular bracket? How is it enforced? At what point are there limitations on how long a parent can, you know, kind of have a kid in front of a camera with the purpose of making money? And how much of that is just the kid having fun? You know, if there's a kid who, you know, the agreement with their parents is, you know, you get your schoolwork done and you can go on Twitch and you can start up your Twitch camera and you know, play games with in front of your audience. You know, that those rules, should they apply to that kid, even though it's something that they have built an audience, but they've done so as kind of an hour a day thing that they're doing online. You know, there are just a ton of questions and scenarios because there's not one single platform or use case here.
So Kids Online Safety Act is what it's called.
That's right.
So, but I mean, I guess the other question too is who's going to enforce it? Is there going to be some type of, you know, system where, I mean, all the different platforms, there's so many different, you know, avenues for a child to be on. I mean, you look up, they're on Facebook, they're on TikTok, you know, so many. So how would you even kind of, I guess, get your arms around that?
It is entirely possible that what this ends up looking like is a set of responsibilities that must then be enforced by the creators of these platforms. Mm. You know, in very much the same way that Facebook, Instagram, TikTok are supposed to have age gates for when is appropriate for a child to create an account. You know, one of the really interesting things about Ryan's World is that Ryan, the star of the channel, is too young to have a YouTube account. If you know, and the same goes for Facebook and you know, Twitter and TikTok and things like that. You almost never see anyone else's face on that channel, or any of the other social, you know, parts that are afforded there. But if a couple of years ago I were to create a Facebook account for my daughter, Facebook would have turned that account off within 30 days because of the laws that are there for, you know, for kids not having social media accounts that are kind of unmonitored by parents. So, you know, a big part of it will likely be leaning on the platforms themselves to hold these creators accountable.
And is that age now, is it 13? You have to be 13 to get on those accounts?
Yeah, so there are different age gates for different accounts. If memory serves, Instagram is 13 and Facebook is 13, but I think TikTok may be different. The age gates there for creating new accounts, and then there's kind of a separate level of account. Facebook has their Facebook Kids account, which allow you to do kind of certain messaging apps and things like that if you're under a certain age. YouTube has the often troubled YouTube Kids account, where it's you're supposed to only be able to see things that are available in certain age gates. That has often run into kind of legal trouble because it has not worked as well as YouTube claimed it is supposed to. So there are a lot of challenges associated with this particular set of rules.
So being an influencer means that you spend a lot of your time, significant amount of time, with the public. As a child, in the case of Ryan, under 13, does he even understand, how much of himself he's really putting out there? I mean, there's just no way to kind of help someone that age understand, right? Even if they do.
Yeah,
enjoy
it's really tough to know. I have a family friend who is she's under the age of 10. She watches more Ryan's World stuff than I think she does normal television. I bet if I were to ask her anything about Ryan, she would probably know better than most people. And that's a really interesting question. How aware is this person that so many people in the world know just a ton of things about them?
Because once you put it out there, it's out there, and
absolutely,
for years,
yeah,
and decades and, to come, it's out there. And someone searches it, it's out there. So finally, Samsung is expected to reveal some new phone models, among other things. What are you expecting to find out with these new phone models?
Yeah, so we've reached that time of year where Samsung and Apple and Google and all these companies will start rolling out their new phones. Samsung is going first this year. It is widely expected that we will see two more of Samsung's folding phones. They have two different brands there. It's the Flip and the Fold. One looks like a traditional old school flip phone, but when you flip it open, it's there's no buttons on the bottom. It's just all screen that folds in half and kind of neatly slides in your pocket. The other is the Galaxy Fold, where it's this much larger screen when you open it up and kind of looks more like a traditional phone, traditional smartphone, I guess I should say, when it's closed. Samsung hasn't said exactly what to expect from this event, but it is also likely that we would see a new watch from Samsung and a new set of headphones to go with it, because Samsung loves to release a new set of headphones when it comes with phones. Typically, as like a, if you pre-order ahead of time, then you'll get it, a significant discount on those headphones. But this is the time of year where Samsung usually rolls out, kind of that set of four devices, and it's pretty expected that that's what we'll see tomorrow.
Are you hearing some pros and cons already about these phones that are being rolled out, or maybe changed just a little bit? Are you hearing some of the good and the bad?
Yeah, so the big thing about folding phones is how much more fragile they are than, say, your standard Samsung phone, in that there's these parts that bend in half and do things, and the screen can potentially be more fragile when it comes to being dropped. It's much harder to put a screen protector on a phone that folds in half, because things like air bubbles and things like that pop up. Samsung, every year that they have released these phones, this is their fourth generation of these phones. They come out and say, hey, we've made them this much stronger and we've done those things. But I definitely still run into folks who have these phones. And, by the time you have reached that kind of 2-year mark of owning these phones, they tend to look a little rougher than your average phone that you end up buying from a place that doesn't fold in half. So it would be interesting to see, how Samsung has continued to address, the fact that people own these phones for more than 6 months, and what they can do to make sure that these phones actually last someone, for the extent of a standard cell phone contract.
Well, I guess every year they come out with new things and many of us try them and decide if we like them or not. That depends on how popular they become. Russell
That's
Holley,
right.
Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, thank you so much for joining us again. Good talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Natasha Williams. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher.